Jawanfek sat down beside me on an ugly leatherette couch. He was dressed in navy blue trousers, a white shirt, and a navy cardigan. And with his soft voice and quiet, gentle demeanor, he appeared more as a college professor than a top aide to someone who has been likened to, at least in some of the Western media, Hitler. I couldn't help but notice his footwear. He was wearing the ubiquitous plastic sandals that are found by the doors of Iranian homes, but not often in offices, and certainly not important government offices. But Mr. Jawanfek was clearly comfortable in them, as comfortable as the team man was in his identical pair when he entered the room with a tray balanced on one upturned palm of an outstretched arm.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulubi. This week, author Hooman Maj reads from his new book. It's called The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran. Maj is a journalist who's published in The New Yorker, GQ, and Salon, among many other publications of note. And he's got the most interesting resume. He's worked in the music industry with U2 and Melissa Etheridge, and for the United Nations, where he has occasionally interpreted for the Iranian president when he visits the United States. Maj is actually the grandson of an Ayatollah. He was educated in England and the U.S. He is uniquely positioned to introduce American readers to a country that too often seems opaque and oppositional. This reading of The Ayatollah Begs to Differ was recorded in September 2008 at the McNally Jackson Bookstore in New York City.
Thank you. I'll read first and then I'll try not to read too much, because you can read yourselves, I presume, if you're in a bookstore. A lot of the media in the last week, media that I've done, is focused in on Ahmadinejad and my interpreting at the UN and so on and so forth, which is very, you know, all about the politics of Iran. This book is not a political book, but there is politics in it, because you can't separate politics from the culture in Iran right now, and particularly as it relates to America. I'm going to read from the first chapter, which is called Persian Cats, but is not about the animals. And I'm going to read a section which may appear to be very political, but is not. And you might see why later. When one enters the presidential compound on Pasteur Avenue, named after the French chemist Louis Pasteur, but curiously and unlike many other Tehran streets with foreign but not foreign revolutionaries' names, never renamed after the revolution, a street closed through traffic, one immediately senses this might be the scruffiest presidential compound of any wealthy country, even some very poor ones, too, in the world. After leaving the taxi, I walked along the sidewalk past the car checkpoint, looking for some indication of which of the many buildings lining the street I should be headed for. There were no signs anywhere, so I simply walked into the first building that showed any sign of life, wrongly, it turned out. But when I emptied my pockets at the metal detector, at least I realized that I had forgotten to check my cell phone at the gate, to the clear disapproval of the guard. No, not the gate, I was told. An office just a few doors down in the direction I came from. Is there a sign? No, there is no sign. It's not necessary. Just two or three doors down. Maybe four. I walked out and scrutinized every door as I retraced my steps until I saw a half-open one and walked into what can best be described as a run-down shack. A revolutionary guard behind a makeshift wooden counter smiled at me. Is this where I check my cell phone? I asked. Yeah. Do you know where Mr. Jawanfek's office is? No. Do you know who Mr. Jawanfek is? No. He's in the president's office. Which building would that be? Straight ahead. The guard handed me a token from my phone, put the phone in a wooden cubbyhole, and then asked if it was off, to which I replied yes. Can you imagine, he said, if people didn't turn off their phones before handing them in? I'd go crazy in here. It was my turn to smile. I headed back in the direction I had just come from, past the building with human activity, or actually a few people dozing in plastic chairs waiting for something or someone, and to the corner of Pasteur, where there was another building with another security guard. I'm looking for Mr. Jawanfek's office. He's supposed to have left my name at the gate, I said to the guard. Who? Mr. Jawanfek, I said slowly. The president's office? Turn left and go to the end of the street, said the guard. I walked out and followed his instructions, walking under towering pine trees and listening to the frequent cries of the hundreds of black crows that seemed to have made the compound, possibly the quietest and most traffic-free part of the metropolis, their home. At the end of the abandoned street, there was another gate with buildings beyond, and I nodded to the security guards inside their glass-enclosed booth as one of them activated the switch for the barrier to lift. I paused for a moment and turned back to the booth. Do you know which building Mr. Jawanfek is in? I asked, leaning toward the small window. Who? Mr. Jawanfek. I don't know. Where are you going? To the president's office, I replied. I think you're in the wrong place. Who are you? If you go in through this gate, you can't come back out. What? You can go in, but you can't come back. For a moment, I could only think of the song Hotel California, but it dawned on me that perhaps I was trespassing in the Supreme Leader's territory. But why hadn't anybody stopped me? And why were these guards willing to let me go through the gate as long as I didn't try to check back out? Perhaps it was a two-week-old beard that made me look like I belonged. Perhaps it was the gray suit and tieless white shirt that identified me as a government official. Beard, gray suit with one undone button, old loafers on the feet. Yes, I belonged here. Well, can you call someone and find out for me where Mr. Javonfek's office is then? I asked, trying to sound authoritative. The guard picked up a phone and turned his back. Go back to the corner building, he said after he hung up. But they told me to come here, I said. That's the president's office, he said, pointing behind me. If you go in here, you can't come out. Hotel California again. I walked back down the street and stepped into the corner building. Mr. Javonfek, I said to the guard. I have an appointment, and he's left my name at the door. What's his number? He replied this time, forgetting that he'd sent me on a long detour from which I may not have returned had I not asked where I was going. I gave the guard the extension, and he dialed it. Ali Akbar Javonfek has the unenviable job of being President Ahmadinejad's top press advisor, as well as his most senior official spokesman. He doesn't work in the presidential press office, and he doesn't sully his days with routine and tedious requests, or with the details of the president's press schedule. But from his large office with views of the towering pine trees in the compound, he ponders the big picture, public diplomacy, if you will, for a boss who seems to have little comprehension of the concept. He is also the president's chief propaganda advisor, which is a concept his boss does have a natural instinct for. A little-known figure in Iranian politics, like many of the president's other top advisors, who wisely, it seems, prefer to stay in the shadow of a president who demands top billing everywhere he goes, he is someone who issues statements only rarely and only on very serious matters, such as his denial that the British servicemen and servicewoman who endured 13 days of captivity in the spring of 2007 were in any way tortured, and in a clever propagandist moment, his announcement that they were free to tell their stories to the Iranian press after they were barred from doing so in England by the British government. Mr. Javonfek is a slight man with a standard-issue Ahmadinejad government haircut, thick, short, black hair parted to one side and partially covering the forehead, and the obligatory, but in his case quite full and quite white, beard. He was examining some faxes when I stepped into his office, but he turned and greeted me in a soft voice. Please, he said, have a seat. In Iranian offices, one is never asked if one would like tea or coffee or any other beverage. It is assumed one will drink tea, and usually within seconds, the office tea man will arrive with a fresh glass and a bowl of sugar cubes. Javonfek sat down beside me on an ugly leatherette couch. He was dressed in navy blue trousers, a white shirt, and a navy cardigan, and with a soft voice and quiet, gentle demeanor, he appeared more as a college professor than a top aide to someone who has been likened to, at least in some of the Western media, Hitler. I couldn't help but notice his footwear. He was wearing the ubiquitous plastic sandals that are found by the doors of Iranian homes, but not often in offices, and certainly not in important government offices. But Mr. Javonfek was clearly comfortable in them, as comfortable as the tea man was in his identical pair when he entered the room with a tray balanced on one upturned palm of an outstretched arm. The office tea man, only one rung above a janitor on the personnel ladder, was dressed just like his boss, save the cardigan. And it struck me that the more socialist aspects of the Islamic Republic, indeed Islam itself, were on full view in this quiet and shabby corner office at the heart of the Republic's power center. The Islamic Revolution had promised in 1979 to do away with class, and more particularly with any royalist, taghuti, which implies class structure, trappings in government and society. And in Javonfek's office, at least, it had succeeded. It was not theater. Javonfek did not strike me as one to affect a style, as it were, nor was I someone, say, a foreigner, whom the presidential office wished to impress with its overt dismissal of Western and sometimes Persian pomp and airs. No, Javonfek and his team man were simply comfortable with who they were. A generation ago, upper-class Iranians would have called them both dahati, peasants, for their appearance. Today, some Iranians still do, both inside the country and in exile, and usually with an air of absolute disgust. But it just doesn't matter anymore. What I wanted to know from the president's top media advisor was who among the top echelon of government officials had thought, other than Ahmadinejad himself, that organizing a conference on the Holocaust in Tehran had been a good idea, at least in terms of how the media would see it. Iranians, particularly those who haven't traveled much outside the country, and no matter what their level of education, have very little knowledge, if any, of the Holocaust. Contemporary European and American history is not taught much in schools, films, and documentaries on the Holocaust rarely make it to Iran, and books on the Holocaust are rarely translated. It was and is still generally accepted by most Iranians that something very bad happened to European Jews under the Third Reich, but because it didn't affect or have anything to do with Iran, not even Iranian Jews, who were mostly unaffected by World War II, the Holocaust was rarely thought about by Iranians until their president decided to make it an issue of great import. Javan Fek was frozen by the question. He stared at me for a long time, not angrily, but more with a bewildered look in his eyes. I was impressed that he didn't want to repeat the standard government line or denial of Holocaust denial. Perhaps he just didn't have an answer that he thought would satisfy me. An Iranian who lives in New York might not, he may have reasoned, understand the subtleties and nuances in his president's pronouncements and actions. I thought of Fuad, my Jewish Iranian friend from Los Angeles, who had explained to me his perspective on Ahmadinejad's Holocaust denial with no small measure of admiration for what he saw as the finest example of Persian Tarof one-upmanship. Ahmadinejad, Fuad reasoned, had in effect said to the Europeans, and in a letter to Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, that he couldn't believe the Europeans had been or could be such monsters, and this at a time when Iran was being portrayed as monstrous. You're not monsters, Ahmadinejad was saying. Surely not. Surely you're a great civilization, a sentiment that could only compel the Europeans, and particularly the Germans, to respond in effect, no, we were. We really were monsters, the very worst kind. And by further asking why Israel had to be created by them, he was essentially getting the Europeans to admit that they were entirely capable of genocide again. It didn't matter, Fuad suggested, that Europeans by and large didn't squirm, for Iranians, Arabs got the message, if only subconsciously. The westernized and west-worshipping Middle Easterners, whom Ahmadinejad loathes with the same passion as Khomeini did, could hear the civilization they so admire shout loud and clear, yes, yes, we committed the very worst genocide in history only a few years ago, and who knows, we could do it again. And Ahmadinejad must have, Fuad said, derived enormous satisfaction in hearing Europeans indignantly insist that their fathers were mass murderers. But Javan Fek was unwilling or unable to explain the thought process behind a Holocaust conference in Tehran, and maybe Fuad had been too generous in his reading of Ahmadinejad's intentions. I think that's probably enough reading.
Two questions. Could you illuminate why the suit with the white shirt and no tie is the uniform, as you describe in that passage of the ruling elite? And also the differentiation between Iranian and Persian, which, you know, most people who are fairly well informed about it will conflate the two together, and yet, as you describe it, there is a differentiation between the two.
Which one do you want me to answer first? Okay. There is actually no difference between Iranian and Persian. Persian is just Persia and Iran are the same and have been forever. Iran happens to be the name that Iranians have used forever. Persia comes from the Greek, and in the 1930s, the Shah of Iran, the Shah at the time, which was the last Shah's father, decided that it should be Iran for everybody, not just for, you know, like Siam and Thailand, like Peking and Beijing and all that. So I use it interchangeably because Persian just sounds better sometimes and than Iranian, but it is basically the same. As to the dress code, it's definitely because there was at the time of the revolution, the revolution was not just an Islamic revolution, it was also a class revolution. And it was an anti-Western revolution, an anti-Western influence revolution at the time. And a suit and although a suit is Western, the tie is even more considered more Western. Ayatollah Khomeini, who actually didn't have an opinion on the subject at the time, for people who are old enough to remember and saw any stuff on TV, the first president of Iran, the first prime minister of Iran, the first foreign minister of Iran under the new government, all wore ties and, you know, nice suits. But apparently, and this is what I've heard, is that some of Khomeini's followers were upset by this, the ones who didn't own suits probably, or didn't own ties, and went to him and said, you know, we need a ruling on this tie issue because that looks really, you know, Talwati, which is, you know, royalist to us. It looks kind of, it's like the same as the Shah's time. So what's your ruling on this? We don't think it's appropriate. And he said, well, I guess it's not appropriate. It's Western, and, you know, it shows too much identification with the West, but beyond that, it makes a sign of the cross. So yeah, definitely don't. Don't worry. So that's the answer to that. Oh, thank you.
Did you actually grow up in Iran, or did you grow up here?
I grew up here.
You grew up here?
Well, here in Europe, and my father was a diplomat, so a bunch of different places. But
so you never actually lived in Iran for
a couple of years when I was young, yes.
Okay.
I did live in Iran when I was young.
My impression is that one of the purposes of your book is to sort of help alleviate some misunderstandings that the West has of Iran. What do you think is one of the most egregious of those, and how do you deal with that in your book?
That they're the enemy. I think that's the most egregious, which is also the most dangerous. And I think that if you look at what's happening right now and the way that we've demonized in the media, and then, you know, a lot of Americans view Iran as an incredibly scary and dangerous place that it's about to launch an attack on a neighboring country, if not on America itself, then I think that's a myth that we have to, you know, kind of, I'm not saying that Iran's intentions, political intentions, are always completely, you know, benign, but they're not looking to go to war anytime soon with anybody. We've kind of done that for them. Afghanistan and Iraq, they're quite happy with that. They didn't have to lose a single soldier and getting rid of two of their enemies. So, you know, the Israel question is the big question, I think. Then there's this image of Iran as being incredibly anti-Semitic and wanting to, well, the president is anti-Semitic, perhaps, but the people aren't really. And even in the regime, there's plenty of people who have criticized him quite openly about his remarks about Israel, like, you know, what's that got to do with us, and so on and so forth, even though the standard Iranian government line is that there's a one-state solution, not a two-state solution to the Palestinian issue, which has a lot of support in the third world, particularly in the Muslim third world. But I think that's the biggest myth, that Iran is this weird, dark place with a bunch of people jumping up and down saying death to America and just itching to get their hands on a nuke to nuke us in New York, which is not the case.
Dovetailing on her question, is it true that the largest population of Jews in the Middle East outside of Israel is in Iran? And secondly, why was it so controversial and ultimately prohibited that Anousheh Ansari wear the Iranian and American flag in her flight to outer space?
Why was it so controversial that you wear that?
And then it was prohibited. She wasn't allowed to wear both flags. She had to only wear the American flag in her mission.
That was an American decision. It had nothing to do with Iran.
Right.
Oh, I see. Okay. First of all, the answer to your first question is yes, Iran does have the second largest population of Jews outside of Israel in the Middle East. And I think that's been pretty well documented, and it's written about often enough. And I actually spent some time with the Jewish community on this last trip when I was there late summer, early September, because I'm doing an article for a magazine on the Jewish community. So, yes, that's true. In terms of why she wasn't allowed to wear the Iranian, I mean, you'd have to ask the American space program why she wasn't allowed to wear it. The Iranians would have loved for her to wear the Iranian flag.
I had an understanding that one of the most popular shows on Iranian TV was about the Holocaust.
Yes.
Would you like to comment on that? Because it seems like they're very well aware of what the Holocaust is about now. If they weren't before,
that certainly one of the most popular shows last year in 2007 was a miniseries on the Holocaust. But it wasn't really a miniseries on the Holocaust, only on the Holocaust. It took place during the Holocaust, and it was a true story, based on a true story about a Iranian diplomat in Paris who had started issuing Iranian passports to Jews so that they could go to Iran. Which is an absolutely true story. It's in the archives of the Foreign Ministry. My father, who's a diplomat, actually knew him. Didn't know him personally because he was older than my father, but knew who he was, and it's documented. So they built this miniseries around that, and it was a very, very popular show. Yeah, so I think a lot more people were aware of. But even in that show, there were some anti-Semitic sections, or at least certainly anti-Zionist sections. And it's like there was this conspiracy to create Israel, and some of the Jews were conspiring with Hitler to, you know, some stuff like that. So there's some factual errors in that show, but they are aware of the Holocaust, yes.
About a year or so ago, there was a very widespread circulating email piece about Iran, Persia, and how cosmopolitan European it was, showing people skiing and what have you. So this is sort of a two-part question. One, how widespread is that? Is that the nature of the country, or is that small pockets? And then secondly, the other thing that circulates on a regular basis is how there is a huge underground looking to overthrow the current government. Is that in place, or is that also just idle chatter?
The first question is, yes, it's true. And the second question, no, there's not a huge underground looking to overthrow the government. It is very cosmopolitan in places. There are ski slopes. People go skiing. People like to dress Western clothes. They go shopping. They do everything that we do here. They drink. They smoke. They do ecstasy. They smoke opium. They go to raves, underground raves. But all of this is done privately. It's not done very openly, except skiing, which is hard to do privately. And in skiing, one of the advantages of skiing is that, you know, it's cold and you get to wear a hat, so you don't even have to wear a chador when you're skiing, as long as your hair is covered. So, you know, the ski clothes on the ski slopes are exactly the same as they would be in, probably not Aspen, because they're more bling. The Iranians like bling, so they're pretty... they're pretty fancy. So if you go to a ski slope in Tehran, outside of Tehran, you would definitely think, oh, this is not Iran. This can't be Iran. But then again, there's a big section of Iran where you don't see that. You see a very conservative religious society that some of those religious conservative people do watch satellite television. They do wear Western clothes. They do also smoke and drink and all that. But it's much less open as it is in parts of Tehran. In terms of a huge underground movement to overthrow the regime, no, there's no huge underground movement. There are dissidents who end up in jail sometimes. They get freed. They continue their activities. They're more careful after they're freed from prison the first time. Sometimes they get thrown back in jail. but generally, they don't really talk about overthrowing the regime so much as they do talk about reform, because regime change is like gets you in jail. But a reform doesn't as much. But it's not as big as we would think or the Voice of America likes us to believe it is.
You're obviously very sophisticated and knowledgeable about Iran before you went and made the journey for this book. What, on this last trip or in writing the book, was there something that just totally surprised you that you hadn't expected to find?
The book is based on a number of journeys I took to Iran. I guess the first time I went back after a long absence being in America, yeah, there were plenty of things that shocked me. The openness of the society shocked me when I first went back. You don't expect it, even though you read about it and you see programs on television. One of the interesting things about Iran is that, and I go back often right now, reasonably often, at least once a year it seems to have been in the past few years, is that even though I, as an Iranian-American, and particularly because of my job and what I do, writing and journalism, I read all the Iranian press. I read everything there is to read about Iran, the American press and the Iranian press, and about Iran. I watch every documentary, every TV show, every interview. And when I go back to Iran after an absence of 6 months or more, I go, what have I just been reading? I mean, it's completely different. It's shocking how different it is to be there. And I'm talking about me, so I can't even imagine what it's like for someone who has no idea or has read little snippets here and there. I think the biggest difference the first time I went back was, the biggest shock was how free and open it is, and all the stuff that happens behind people's doors, behind in their homes, privately, but also how open it is in terms of politics and how openly people talk about politics. Because I grew up at a time when there was a Shah and there was a Savak and people were afraid of speaking out, and, the Savak was going to take... I had friends in college who were, when they went back to Iran, were arrested by the Savak and beaten and stuff like that. And so you kind of had to imagine if that was what it was like under the Shah, well, my God, under the Islamic Republic, it's got to be 10 times worse. And in that respect, it's not. Unless, of course, you walk around the street saying death to Islam, in which case you'll be, death will visit you. But other than a few red lines, there's a lot more openness than I expected.
You could speak to the female Persian experience and if that kind of contributes to, your thoughts on there being a paradox insofar as, do they feel oppressed or is that kind of a Western imposition?
Right. I don't know if I'm best qualified to talk about the female experience Persian, but from what I've seen and what people I've talked to and all that, yes, to some degree they feel oppressed, but they've made a lot of gains, actually gains even compared to women in Iran have made gains, even compared to the Shah's time. A lot of the laws in Iran, other than hijab, and I'll get to that in a minute, other than covering yourself or, the clothing laws in Iran, Iran has made a lot of gains. Iran's had a vice president who's a woman. Every office in every government office in Iran at every level, there are women employees, women drive, and everything else. A lot of the laws that were created that are sexist laws were created under the Shah's time and the Shah's father's time. For example, the right of a woman to travel outside the country without her husband's permission, it still doesn't exist, but that was under the Shah's time, that you had to get your husband's permission when you wanted to get a passport, or if you didn't have a husband, your father's permission. But they're challenging those, and actually effectively so. Even that particular law now is being challenged in Parliament, and it probably will change in the next year or two. So there have been a lot of advancements, and in terms of feeling oppressed, again, it's hard to say because I don't experience that. But the women that I've talked to when I'm in Iran say, you know, look, the hijab issue is the last thing we worry about. Americans should not be focusing on this chador and hijab thing. You know, walking down the street with a scarf is not the biggest problem. We have other issues to deal with. And by focusing in on that, you know, chador or the hijab, you actually kind of diminish the other issues or make them non-existent in the minds of Westerners or in the minds of even Iranians. But no, Iranian women don't generally think about it very much. It's become a habit. They put a scarf on and they test the limits of how far they can push the scarf back. And despite Ahmadinejad's government's crackdown in the last year, which has been widely reported here, I was there a couple of weeks ago, and it's as far back as it can go, the scarf. In some cases, completely off when they're on the back of a motorcycle with their boyfriend, and you know the wind just blows the scarf right off. Because you know they're supposed to wear helmets, but they don't. So.
Thank you. I heard an interview on radio. I think it was today. And
okay.
You mentioned, is it Taaruf?
Taaruf, yeah.
Taaruf. I wonder if you'd go into that a bit. It sounded like an interesting part of the culture.
Well, it is an interesting part of the culture. It's a very difficult concept to explain in just a few sentences. So I recommend you read my book because it's dealt with in detail. But it's basically the Iranian, kind of the polite banter, which can be confusing to Westerners because it's taken far beyond the usual, you know, oh, that was a great meal when you know it wasn't, kind of polite repartee. And, you know, as I said, it's a complicated and a long discussion that I'd be happy to go into. It'll take a long time. So I think I'd prefer if you bought the book.
When you're speaking to a cab driver, for example, how that exchange would involve Taaruf?
Yeah, I mean, people basically don't want to take your money, or they pretend like they don't want to take your money. So you have to insist everything. You want to buy a pack of gum. You know, you go up to, you know, there's a long line. You go up to the little newsstand, you say a pack of gum, and then you'll say, well, how much is it? And you'll say, oh, it's not worthy. Well, yeah, so, you know, well, yeah, but I still have to pay. No, it's not worthy. Not for someone like you, this it's meaningless, just a pack of gum. So then you go, okay, well, I understand that, but you have to make a living, so please tell me how much it is. Well, however much you want to pay. And I was like, well, it makes it very difficult. And you do that you have to do that all day long. But there are advantages. People take advantage of you. Like, you know, you'll go through in a cab. I'll get in a cab and, you know, you drop me off and I'll say, how much is it? He said, oh, it's unworthy. No, please, you're my guest and all that. So, no. Finally, he agrees that I'm not his guest and I'm not quite that worthy. And he'll say, well, okay, you just decide. How much do you want to pay? And I said, no. You tell me. I don't know how much I'm supposed to pay. Cabs don't have meters. And he'll say something that I know is at least 1,000 tumans more than it would have been had he just, you know, so there's advantages. And at that point, you're too embarrassed, you know. He says, it should have been 2,500 tumans, which is $2.50. And he says, 3,500 tumans. You go, well, yesterday the cab ride was only 2,500. But, you know, at that point, he's offered you're his guest and all that. So he's screwed you, basically. Yeah. And that happens in politics, too, which we don't understand.
Hi.
Hi.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too. To what extent does the Supreme Leader help set foreign policy?
He doesn't help. He sets it. Foreign policy is one of his areas. Actually, all of Iranian politics, I mean, they don't call him supreme for nothing. He is the Supreme Leader. He's the ultimate leader of Iran. He makes all decisions if he wants to. He chooses not to on the day-to-day affairs of state. But foreign policy, he's very particularly involved in, and he has his own foreign policy team, and they set the policy, and the administration, whichever the administration is, reform, conservative, they just execute that foreign policy. There are language changes, which is unfortunate because we hear a different language, whether it's coming from someone like Khatami or Ahmadinejad. But essentially, the policy doesn't change. Or if it does change, it's the supreme leader who's decided it's going to change. And he also is the commander-in-chief. So the military, all arms of the military report directly to him, the Revolutionary Guard, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force. So he actually has a lot of power, far more power than people think he has. He chooses not to always exercise it. Only when he's depressed. And when I was in Iran, he was depressed. Or that was the rumor in Iran, was that he was suffering from depression, which I said to people, aren't you worried? The supreme leader's suffering from depression? You're not worried? Like, well, he's always been depressed. You know. So.
All right, so I think someone has to ask this question. How much credence should we invest in his insistence that the nuclear program is just peacefully oriented?
I think that, well, it's not just him. You have to listen to every other person, all the other ayatollahs who are actually the ones who decide. For example, the supreme leader, more than anyone else, who's issued a fatwa against nuclear warheads, bombs. A fatwa is a serious thing. I mean, a fatwa can be revoked by him. But interestingly enough, if he dies, a fatwa can't be revoked. So as long as the supreme leader is alive, he can revoke his fatwa and say, well, you know, I just changed my mind. Nuclear bombs are okay now. So, yes, he could do that. But he's not going to do that because that's an embarrassing thing. They don't usually do that. One of the reasons they never rescinded the fatwa on Salman Rushdie was because, well, first because Khomeini died, but also even during his lifetime, they were trying to get him to rescind it. And it's just embarrassing to say I was wrong. They won't do it. George Bush won't do it. Why would, you know, the supreme leader of Iran do it? So I think that based on my conversations with a lot of these people in power, I don't think they are actually developing nuclear weapons right now. But they are aware that they can with nuclear enrichment. That's a fact, that if you're able to enrich uranium, that you're able to build a bomb. It's the most difficult part of building a bomb. So, yes, they're aware of that, and it's a possibility that one day they would decide that maybe it is time to build one as a deterrent, or I doubt very much, it doesn't seem to me that anyone in Iran, from the most hardline to the most, you know, liberal, has any intention of attacking another country. So,
can you speculate on the benefit to the Iranian government, why Ahmadinejad actually the front man for the government? If his beliefs, his statements are so extreme and counter to the beliefs of the, you know, general population of Iran, what is the benefit of to the Iranian government of actually him being the president?
He was elected. I mean, the supreme leader is not going to, he's got a stability of a country to think about. He could remove him. He could have parliament impeach him. There was even calls for that at one point during his presidency. But, you know, in the same way that Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to impeach George Bush because it will lead to the instability of the United States government, they think the same way. They're not that different. The Iranian mind is not that different from the American mind or any mind, actually. We're all human. So they think that, you know, he was elected. And if the decision is made by the supreme leader that it's probably better for him not to be president next time, you'll get subtle hints. Right now, he hasn't made that decision. In fact, some people say the opposite. He's been saying things in support of Ahmadinejad. And then some people, while I was in Iran, this is an interesting thing, this is a paradox, some people were saying, well, the supreme leader said that because he knows that people won't listen to him. So if he says, I support Ahmadinejad, they'll go and do the exact opposite, which they actually did once when Khatami was elected president the first time. The supreme leader quite openly said, you know, he was a supporter of Nader Nuri, who was his conservative arch rival. And, of course, people voted overwhelmingly for Khatami. But the advantage is basically, I mean, we think of Iran as a dictatorship, and it's not a dictatorship. It's autocratic. There are autocratic elements about the political system. But it's not a dictatorship. And people actually value the vote. And there's a lot of talk about who the next president's going to be. And they're not talking about it being fixed. They're talking about, you know, who people are going to vote for. And you have to also remember that what we hear Ahmadinejad say in our media, living in New York, is not the whole story. Because what he says when he goes on tour to the provinces and talks to the poor and all that, he's saying something, you know, which we don't hear about because we don't really care about. You know, and he's talking about the economy of Iran and how he's going to, you know, clamp down on corruption and all that kind of stuff, which resonates with the working class in Iran and the religious class. And then, of course, he, you know, goes on and on about the Messiah and stuff like that also resonates with his face. So it's not everything we hear here.
I think we have to wrap it up there.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mbarek.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.